What we do believe is that that statue doesn't belong in the middle of our downtown, especially if we're a community in which we're trying to provide equity and we're saying that we're one of the best places to live in the country for all people. Then we have to make sure that we maintain safe spaces in our parks for all people. So in terms of selling the statue or auctioning it off, we just believe that it should be in a more appropriate place. So if there's a park service, or if there is a civil rights museum, excuse me, a Civil War museum, or somewhere in which individuals believe that they can pay the proper homage and respect to Mr. Lee through a government entity of, or something of that nature, then they have every right to auction off, or excuse me, purchase the statue. And we've received several calls for it.
Well, we want to thank you very much, Wes Bellamy, for joining us. Vice Mayor of Charlottesville, Virginia, youngest person ever to be elected to the Charlottesville City Council, the only African-American currently on that council, leading the opposition to the Robert E. Lee statue in Charlottesville, Virginia, the home of Thomas Jefferson. That does it for the show. If you'd like to sign up for our Daily Digest email list, get our headlines every day and news alerts, just text the word Democracy Now! Without a space, Democracy Now! To 66866. And you can get behind-the-scenes updates and stories from Democracy Now! On Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and more. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gattis, Dana Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Trina Ndura. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, I'm Ed Melnick. In solidarity with San Francisco's 50-year anniversary of the Summer of Love, I'm inviting you to join me for a two-hour special Monday sampler on August 7th.
For the benefit of Mr. Kite, there will be a show tonight on Trampoline.
From the 1967 music scene, music from artists like Janis Joplin, the Jefferson Airplane, the Beatles, and many others will be featured. Join me for 2 hours to tune in, turn on, and drop out. That's Monday, August 7th, 2 to 4 p.m.
If you're going to San Francisco, be sure to wear some flowers in your hair.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Albina Jazz Festival at the Stingray Cafe on Saturday, August 12th, and Sunday, the 13th, in Portland. The Albina Jazz Festival is a two-day jazz festival featuring performances by King Louie and LaRonda Steele, Ron Steen and Jam Session, the Chris Brown Quartet, and many more. Again, that's the Albina Jazz Festival on Saturday, August 12th, and Sunday, the 13th, at the Stingray Cafe, 240 North Broadway Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio. This is More Talk Radio. I'm your host today, Linda Olson Osterlund. Cecil and Celeste are off for the day, and our show today should be having you all call in. I hope it will. We're going to have two members of Portland Resistance here. It's Greg McKelvey and James Offsink. Do I say that correctly? Welcome to KBOO, you guys.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
Thank you for being here in this early morning as we're all waking up. And they're going to be talking about two important things and anything more that you want to talk to them about within the same topic area. They're going to be talking about an announcement they made that if the if the mayor selects Marshman, the current interim police chief, as the permanent police chief, that they're going to be looking into how to recall Wheeler. The second thing that they've done most recently is issue a Let me find what I was looking to, the open letter to candidates. And so they've written a pretty extensive open letter to the candidates for the police chief, only one other of whom we know. There's a lot of secrecy around this selection of the next police chief. And as we know, there's been lots of difficulty with the police and the public here in this city. So it's very important who gets selected. We have a long history of having police chiefs with integrity problems who are thrown out of office over and over again. Barely get used to them before they're gone. So this is a very, and you know, we can make jokes about it, but it's a very important issue. And so we have Portland Resistance here to talk about it. And I'll let them get into that and start talking to you about that right now. I want to let you know that this is More Talk Radio. We do invite you to call in. The number is 503-231-8187. We're going to talk for about 10 minutes, but then we'll be open for your calls. Please go ahead and get in line. We do really want to hear from you around this issue. So I want to go ahead and see which one of you, James or Greg, would like to start in talking about your announcement and also the open letter that you've written.
I'm happy to start.
Yeah, go ahead.
And this is James is speaking.
Yeah, thank you. So we, as Portland's Resistance, have been following the hiring of the new police chief really closely. Right now is really a moment for criminal justice reform across the country. And here in Portland, as one of the most progressive cities in the United States, this is an area that we should be leading on, and instead we're trailing. There are many places in the country that are doing policing better than we are, and we've seen time and again how our law enforcement disproportionately affects communities of color and people experiencing houselessness and other marginalized communities at rates that far exceed those of whites in our community. So we have been calling over the last, I don't know, 6 or 7 months, maybe even more, for some pretty radical changes to the way that we do policing in our city. And as the new police chief hiring has occurred, we've been really following close to candidate Wheeler and later Mayor Wheeler's statement that this would be a public process that would really involve the community in selecting the top cop for Portland. So we have been tracking that really closely and have been disappointed throughout that it has not been as public of a process as we would have wanted. We've been encouraging the community to participate in the ways that are available, like filling out the community survey that the city released, and at every step have been very closely following what's happened. And so when we're now down to, you know, the final candidates, or potentially the mayor is supposed to make an announcement even as soon as this week as to who the next police chief will be, and the public has not had any opportunity to find out what even the questions that were asked of these police the candidates or how they responded. And we felt like it's important for the community to know who our next police chief is going to be and where they stand on the issues that are really important to Portland. So we published an open letter that we sent to any to all of the candidates who had been identified when there were still 6 in the running, and also published, you know, to our website and sent out to the media so that hopefully even candidates who had not made their names public would still be interested in responding. And we did not hear back, as
no, we did not.
You maybe would have expected, but we hope that with the announcement of whoever's selected, that they will at that point respond to the questions that we and other groups have posed. And we're really interested in looking at having an open forum with the police chief once they're identified, and partnering with other groups to do that and to really have that first interaction with the people of Portland.
Well, one of the things that I read was that in this selection process, some of the candidates didn't want to have their names made public, probably because of their jobs where they're working at the time. Others were more open to be public. But the process itself that was done, I don't believe we even got to see the questions that were asked or know what community members, supposedly there, well, I believe there were community members on a panel that got to speak to each one of these candidates, when I think the candidates were still six, but and they got to spend us up to an hour asking questions, but they were given those questions by the staff. They weren't generating their own questions, so perhaps they were able to later, but according to this article, the staff of the city gave them the questions to ask, and we don't even know who these community leaders are. There's one who has come forward who said that he believed, I'll seek his name out later, it's in here in the scanner, that he believed there was a good selection of people on those panels. But once again, that's nice. Everybody can tell us it was good, but it's secret, and we don't know that.
So... Go ahead.
So we ended up...
And this is Greg.
Greg McKelvey. We did a public records request to find out who was on that panel, and we did get the list of people that were on there, and I think there were 9 categories, and one of which was the Portland business community, another one of which was police. There was only one houseless advocate. There were many people that were there for race issues and many great names that did the interviews. But the thing is, we still have no idea how these people were chosen. We have no idea why the process was supposed to be so secret right here. So in this, the process starts off with a community input survey where you have to register an account, which is already prohibitive to many of the people that are most over-policed in our city. So in our city, the most over-policed people are protesters, people of color, poor people, and houseless people. And those people have less of a chance to be on the internet, especially if you're houseless. How are you going to be on the internet? What address do you put into this system to have your input heard? And I would argue that those are the people that we need to hear from the most in what they're looking for in a police chief.
Yes, let's talk about what you are looking for in a police chief. What is it you're asking of the police that you want them, you know, this new chief to live up to? What kinds of standards are you asking for?
Well, there's a couple of things. I think first off, right now we're at a point where whoever gets hired, we will know nothing about them or close to nothing about them. So we're basically just going to have to see.
Unless it's Chief Marshman.
Unless it's Marshman. But we would have to see from trial and error what kind of police chief that is. And that's a really scary prospect for the groups that I was talking about that are already over-policed. But in terms of what we're looking for, I think it's easy to look to Mike Marshman and see exactly what we're not looking for. Somebody that over-polices protests, somebody that's willing to disproportionately arrest people of color. And I think the entire city of Portland wants to be a sanctuary city and stand up to the federal administration. But as long as we're arresting people of color at disproportional rates, why do people get deported? They get deported because they have been arrested. So what kind of sanctuary city are we if we are continuously throwing people, the most vulnerable people in our community, into the hands of ICE by arresting them for low-level crimes at a disproportional rate?
And even people who, you know, aren't immigrants, you know, we're really contributing to the prison industrial complex, too, by over-policing communities and, you know, starting people down a path that just has no good ending in our criminal justice system.
Yeah, there's lots of statistics that show that if you, even with young people in school, a first contact with the police in terms of like actually being interviewed or talked to, sat down and talked to, that can change the whole course of someone's life and does change the whole course if you look at it statistically. Each individual is different, but statistically people fare far worse once they've been involved with the police. I want to let our listeners know now is a great time to pick up that phone and call in. It's 503-231-8187. We want to hear from you and what you think about the police chief. I know to some degree I've been cynical about police chiefs and not paid that much attention to the process, because even when I've been hoping for a good police chief, maybe we could go back and say Tom Potter and community policing was closer to the kind of policing and the kind of policeman we'd want to see. I know people from that time who say there were policemen who made it a point of really becoming part of the community and firmly believed in community policing, but that changed and that one was thrown out along with other models of how to engage the public. So I'd like to hear any of you out there who have experience under the different chiefs, but I've been one of those people who said it doesn't matter which chief they get in, we're going to have problem with the police. This is the United States and that's the way it goes. But I do think it is important, and I think even if we can't affect the actual selection action, which maybe because of what you guys are doing in Portland Resistance, we can, and what other activists are doing. But even if we can't, even if we get another one who has an integrity issue problem and a lack of understanding or the right understanding of racial issues, even then, I've been cynical about who we'll get. But I think we need to know, and I do think we need to bring it more and more into the public and say we have something to say about how we're policed.
Yeah, I think police culture is broken across the country. So it's hard to say we're going to find somebody that has the credentials to be the type of police chief that we want to be, because it's hard to find a city that is policing people, especially protesters or people of color, houseless individuals, how we would prefer that to occur. So it is discouraging, but I would also argue that the police chief hire is probably most likely the most important hire that the city makes, and whoever is hired will probably be around longer than Ted Wheeler. So the decision is very important, and I think that now more than ever we need somebody that is reform-minded, somebody that holds the values that Ted Wheeler did during his campaign. I think would be really great.
Right, a real data-driven approach to, we want to see the numbers that show that fewer people from communities of color are being stopped and arrested. We want to see those numbers all the way through the system, and we want the chief of police to hold staff, rank-and-file officers accountable all the way down, that they're treating everyone in the community equitably, they're de-escalating situations whenever possible, and I mean, to the greatest extent possible, we'd love to see police officers go unarmed by and large. I mean, for the most part, public servants do not need to have weapons that kill people.
One of my favorite things would be to get the police to stop doing chases, unnecessary chases, when there's somebody who's suspected of a very minor crime and they chase them down like they did with Quanis Hayes. If you read their transcripts, that of course they got a lot of time before they had to testify and what they had to say, but it's clear that they worked themselves up as they were going after Quanis Hayes. And so here comes this young man out from under, out from beside a building with, trying to decide, are they yelling at him hands up or hands down, and he's dead today. Mm-hmm. And I believe that they did dump a gun on him. They keep saying they found this replica gun, but they've never once said that they found his fingerprints on it. They would have said that.
They've also never said that he brandished the gun towards them as a reason to be shot. So the implication when they say we found this gun is he must have pulled it and we had no option but to shoot because we can't tell if that's a real gun or not. But that's not even a part of the story. And also, a houseless person was shot by the police on that same exact day, also coincidentally found with a replica gun.
Yeah, and when they leave something out, but they say it over and over again on the news shows, and he was found with a replica gun, and he'd had one earlier, but they never say fingerprints, and you just know if they had that, they'd say, and we know he was holding it. We do have one caller on the line. I want to go ahead and let that caller on, and we can continue this conversation. It's Roberta. Roberta, go ahead.
Good morning, everybody. I have a comment that ties in with the policing issue. A caller in Takebu had mentioned the increase in prison labor in this country and mentioned Whole Foods as one of the prime violators, and turns out to be true. I did do my research online, and along with the increase in corporations using prison labor, that ties in with the increase in the ICE sweeps, and a lot of these immigrants are not being deported. They are being used as prison labor, and this ties in with the lack of community policing, not just in our area but all over the country. And I just wanted to thank Francis, as the caller, for calling in this very important and often not paid attention to enough issue. So thank you so much, and keep up the great work, you all.
Right, thanks, Roberta. Right. I totally.
Okay, thank you. Bye bye.
I totally agree that the prison labor issue is something that we're dealing with across the country and is just heinous. I mean, we need to determine as a society, or I mean, I think we need to move away from prison and jail being seen as completely punitive and instead move to restorative at a time when, you know, millions of especially young black men are entered into our prison system. We need to figure out a way to prepare people for reentry into society, stop all of the after effects, you know, people having trouble finding housing and jobs because they have a criminal record. And oftentimes that criminal record is for things that potentially, you know, white people would not have even been stopped for in the first place, and certainly not accelerated through the criminal justice system.
Well, and I think when we see the disproportionate stopping of people of color, what, 27 times more for spitting on the sidewalk, 8 times more for, I mean, for very, very minor things, people of color, especially African Americans, but people of color in general, are targeted. And so that on that pipeline to making, you know, why should a store like Whole Foods be using prison labor except to really, really lower the costs of labor? They're certainly not there to help train people in how to have jobs when they come out. I think that was really important that Roberta brought that up. I want to encourage others of you to call in with your questions and your comments. The number is 503-231-8187. And we do have another caller. It's Mike. Mike, welcome to KBOO.
Yes. You know, I wanted to bring up the fact that you guys are lumping all the people of color together. First of all, when you talk about sanctuary cities, this is primarily targeting
immigrants,
undocumented people that just come into the country, so they get preferential treatment. Now, when you show preferential treatment to one group to the detriment of another group, that's not equal protection under the law. So when you talk about sanctuary cities, you're not talking about equal protection under the law, because black people or no other group of people in this state benefits from sanctuary cities. Only one group. Now, also, as being African American, I've been called the N-word within the last year a couple of times, and they've been by Hispanic people. And I have experienced racism from Hispanic people. So they come here and they benefit, but they're racist. If you go to places like McDonald's or the mobile communication places and any place that Hispanics work, they're all Hispanics. They don't promote diversity. They practice racism.
Well, Michael, I wanna say that you know you have your direct experience, and I'm not gonna deny it at all, and I'm not gonna deny that immigrants, people from other countries, sometimes pick up the established attitudes of the country, the dominant narrative from the rulers of the country, and can have racist attitudes. But I think it's not my experience, certainly, that Hispanics as whole are racist towards African Americans. And I think that in many cities, they form all sorts of coalitions and leagues together. I think we do need to call people of color, but you're right. We need to call out the differences. We need to say how the system treats people differently. Let's talk about Native Americans too, which can come right down at the bottom of it. Do you want to have something to say, Greg?
Yeah, I think there's many reasons to say people of color. There's also many reasons to separate when you're saying separate things. But when when the police officers pull somebody over, they are seeing color, and Hispanics are more likely to be shot by the police for being armed or unarmed than white people are, just as black people are. And both all people of color experience white supremacy and the effects of white supremacy. But I would say that I think the caller mentioned something about we're singling out a group and giving them preferential treatment. I don't think that immigrants get preferential treatment at all. They're treated horribly in this country. But and then, well, let me say one more point. And then And then you said to the detriment of everybody else. And I really think that the entire state and the entire country benefits from immigration, especially the work of migrant farm workers. Our culture benefits, the entire state and country benefits. And it's not just for a certain group of people that's getting preferential treatment, because by and large, the entire city, statistically, not the entire city, but a large proportion of the city wants to be a sanctuary city and wants that word to hold meaning.
One thing I would like to add is that the average age of a farm worker dying is 49. It's only lower, I believe, with the indigenous people of our nation. So that gives you an indication of a lack of preferential treatment.
And lastly, when it comes to racism, racism is not just prejudice in general, but being able to use that prejudice via the power structures of white supremacy and the institutions that white supremacy has built throughout the country. So calling someone the N-word, while is deplorable and not right from any race, at the same time, that is not equal to the systematic oppression of people of color, black people throughout the country that has happened via the institutions of white supremacy that have been set up through generations.
You know, I understand what you're saying, but I'm assuming that you guys are probably all Caucasian, speaking on how white people treat black people.
And I'm black, sir.
Pardon?
I'm black.
Okay, all right. Now, if there's not, okay, you want to keep saying that illegal immigration is affecting agriculture, but you know something? Back in the day, the jobs, the restaurant jobs, McDonald's jobs, these kind of jobs, young black teenagers used to work these jobs. They don't have these jobs no more because these influx of undocumented comes in, and they get these jobs, and if you go to McDonald's, you won't see anybody on these jobs, basically, but Hispanics. That right there, that's not diversity. That's not diversity.
Michael, I think what you're talking about is true. The state will use the divisions between us and will emphasize those in many ways. It will come out in lots of ways. And I think that it's what you're seeing, I'm not denying your experience of seeing that, but I think that that doesn't mean that Hispanics are here to our detriment. It means the system uses our differences to hold us all down and to turn us against each other.
It's an economic thing, because most of the the undocumented that comes into this country, they're affecting poor people or unskilled people or people that dropped out of school, don't have a high school education. But as you go up the ladder to skilled jobs and wealthy people, the undocumented don't affect those people. So they're down at the bottom competing with the unskilled American labor for jobs, and they're getting these jobs because they're going to work cheaper. So what you're saying is not true.
Well, I'm going to let Greg respond to you, and then we'll go on to the next caller.
Well, so we have, I'll push back and say a majority of the people working minimum wage jobs, especially in Oregon, are not undocumented workers. And a majority of the Hispanics working minimum wage jobs are also not undocumented workers. Who's taken more jobs away from the black community is the corporation. The way that capitalism has worked itself out in automation takes way more jobs than undocumented workers. And there's also many studies and statistics that show that a majority of undocumented workers, especially the farm workers, are doing jobs that by and large Americans don't want to do.
So thank you for that, Greg, and we've let Michael go. Thank you, Michael, for your contribution to the conversation. We do have another caller on the line. James, thank you for calling.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, just to respond to that guy's comments, you know, what he said before, I think it's really important to realize that, you know, illegal immigrants aren't taking jobs. I mean, there have been stories shown, like the CEO of Tyson Chicken was like, he was literally paying people to bring in, you know, to bring in immigrant workers to pay them under the table. You know, it's like there's been a huge, you know, that's something that, you know, maybe could be another thing to explore. But anyway, more on topic, you know, my mom, she dealt with, you know, we dealt with a lot of unfair treatment by police growing up. You know, granted, I'm a lighter-skinned Hispanic, and I speak English. It's my first language. My Spanish needs a lot more practice, but, you know, we experienced a lot of that. My mom got harassed on several occasions just because she had, you know, just because she had that last name. You know, once they got her in the system, it was just like for minor things that, you know, you wouldn't normally, you know, getting pulled over for not using your turn signal to go into a driveway, you know, right. something absolutely ridiculous. And, you know, and people who don't have a family member who's in the system, they don't understand that these things are real. You know, my mom had a terrible time trying to find a job after she got out of jail. You know, she doesn't even really have a job now. She sells stuff on eBay.
And that's a hard thing for a child to grow up with, is watching their parent be the subject of mistreatment and lack of respect. And it does a lot of hard things for you when you are a young person.
You know, another thing too is, you know, that the, you know, that you guys brought up, you know, our family, I'm third generation Mexican-American. And, you know, when my great-grandma and great-grandma came over here, you know, they were the subject of a lot of really painful racist rhetoric. So my grandpa is, you know, Francisco, he went by Frank. He gave all of the kids Anglo names, George, Lloyd, Ben, stuff that was easy to pronounce. His kids didn't even know his name was Francisco till the day that he died.
Wow.
You know, and my grandpa, and my grandma were huge. I mean, and I think people really don't understand that people of color can't be racist, because people like to use the term racist from the dictionary, but the dictionary is written by racists. You know, we gotta look at the institutional power of it. And the truth of the matter is, my grandpa threw out the N-word. He called, you know, spades. You know, when I was listening to Boys to Men, he was like, "Why are you listening to that jungle music?" You know, the same stuff that white people used to say when Buddy Holly was playing Bo Diddley. You know, and so people don't understand that. You know, they do. You're right. Hispanics have absolutely, who want to survive, have adopted that racist rhetoric, just the same as that fellow Mike who on the last call was saying, well, the immigrants are coming over here taking our jobs. Who does that sound like? Bill O'Reilly. Who does that sound like? Grace, you know, Nancy Grace. You know, it's white supremacy, like you said, using divisions to get us at each other's throats. You know, there's a lot of great people online who talk about the fact that, you know, Hispanics, we have a lot of black in our ancestry, but we don't talk about it because being dark skinned isn't beautiful.
I don't think anyone can come to our country and not begin to be affected by the racism and the rhetoric. I really appreciate your call. I want to ask you, I want to have our guests, Greg and James, talk to this and ask you how you see the selection of a new police chief affecting people like your mom, and what do you want to see in a new police chief?
You know, honestly, what I'd like to see in a new police chief is somebody who is willing to take a punch. Because the truth of the matter is that, you know, when it comes to race relations, it's like, you know, people want to preserve the idea that, or the image that America is free, rather than working to make it free. Just the same as there's people out there who want to protect the image that all cops are good, rather than trying to work to help make.
So what do you mean when you say you want a person who can take a punch?
Well, the fact of the matter is that if we're going to solve the problems of racism, it's going to have to come at a lot of hard criticism that you know, the police are going to have to take.
Yeah, James, I can, this is also James, I completely agree, and I think that, you know, one of the... most important things for the new police chief is to be somebody who can learn from the mistakes of a former administration and from what the community is telling them. And we were actually really encouraged, to the mayor's credit, that the original job posting for the police chief specifically called out Portland's systemic history of racism and expected the new police chief to have, you know, strategies and experience in addressing that. So we hope that the mayor stays true to that value and holds the chief accountable and selects the chief who's most prepared to do that.
You know, I just one more thing, because I know you guys have to move on, but you know, I work as a care provider in the state of Oregon, and we have this training we go through called OIS, Oregon Intervention System. And what we learn is that we have to take punches as care providers. We work with people whose behaviors go from completely docile and innocent all the way up to people who are ready to rip a banister off a staircase and chase you down with it. And the truth of the matter is that you're going to find people in our system who have worked with care providers and hate them. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't, you know, because they don't see you, they see your role. You know, if you met them outside of being a care provider, you guys might actually have a relationship. But the truth of the matter is that you're going to deal with people like that. And I've taken several punches from
clients.
Well,
I think your point is really important, and I think the training is important. It's the kind of training we want and for our community police, is we want them to understand that, they're going to run into an angry person,
right.
And it's not going to be pleasant. But how can they handle that in a way that's going to serve the community?
Yeah, I actually have a question about that, James, with respect to your training, because the police, it was recently reported by the compliance officer community liaison, who's kind of the entity that oversees the settlement agreement that we have with the department, that the Portland Police Bureau has with the Department of Justice, because of their treatment of people with mental illness. And they went through a training where they stood police officers up against a wall and then had them turn around quickly and were presented with different scenarios. So in the first scenario, they turned around and somebody has a gun that is pointed at them. And the vast majority of police officers drew their own gun and fired at that person, not knowing anything other than they turned around. Then they did a second experiment directly following that, where they stood police officers up against the wall again. They had them turn around and there was just a person with their hands in their pocket, and more than 50% of officers drew their weapon again. And I wonder what kind of training you receive as a care provider with people who, you know, are experiencing mental illness, and how that might be applicable to our police officers.
Well, it's just recognizing that, you know, the training is really just, you know, you don't make fists, you don't use thumbs, you know, you deflect the oncoming attacks, and you work to de-escalate the situation with your words and your body posture. And if that doesn't work, you bring in another person that, you know, if depending, and it's all based on what is in the person's file, you know, what type of restraints are applicable to that person. You know, and it varies from person to person, but, you know, you work with them, you get to know them, you develop a relationship with them, and that's the biggest thing, is it's like, when we have to use those holds, we consider that a failure, because we did not do our best to keep the situation from escalating to that point. The point is that we should never have to use it, but it's there.
Right, and I hope that the incoming police chief and the police administration feels similarly about police officers, that it is a failure when use of force is necessary.
Well, thank you for calling in, James. This is a good conversation and good points you're bringing up. I'm going to go ahead and move on now. I do want to let people know what's going to be coming up on KBOO this morning. At 9 on the Old Mole Variety Hour, low-wage workers across the South are fighting for the $15 minimum wage. The U.S. Congress tries to outlaw the boycott divestment sanctions campaign against goods made in the occupied West Bank. And we'll have a review of the film Moana and Disney's attempts to deal with race and gender in animated films. At 10, Locus Focus revisits Barbara Bernstein's 2002 documentary, Rivers That Were, exploring the consequences of redesigning nature to fit commercial needs. At 11 on HealthWatch, Dr. Marilyn Glenville has a 7-step brain protection plan in her book, Natural Solutions for Dementia and Alzheimer's. And at 11:30, it's Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. KBOO keeps you informed and involved, and we need your help. Go to KBOO.fm and click on donate to become a member today. We're also going to be having our fall membership event coming up in September, so please stay attentive to that and participate in any way that you can. I want to see if we have another caller on the line now. We have Dougie on the line, and Dougie, thank you for calling KBOO.
Thank you. I used to live in Portland. I moved in 2004, and right now I live in Atlanta, Georgia.
Well, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, you're still a fan.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I've been tuning in lately because after the election of Donald Trump, I just wanted to get the hell out of here.
Come on back.
You know, it was, you know, I started listening to KBOO after the WTO events up in Seattle. I had been there, and KBOO was the only one reporting the truth. So, you know, I found myself always turning to KBOO. It's good to hear you turning to KBOO from Atlanta.
Yes. And it's amazing. The programming at KBOO has improved. It's even more professional than when I left. So you're definitely a beacon of light and hope for the rest of the country. So keep up the great work.
Thank you.
The reason I called, you know, I heard the caller calling in blaming immigrants, and it's almost like he has taken on the racism that's come from Trump and the alt-right and Breitbart News, Stephen Bannon, Stephen Miller, and their whole agenda, just in case, you know, just in case he doesn't know, is that, you know, they want America to be more white. They're afraid of the shifting demographics. There's a pushback after there were so many African-American voters that came out and voted during the Obama administration. And just notice how all the attention has been distracted away from Wall Street, away from the elites and the people who created the economic crisis in America, where we now have the worst inequality that we've had in over 100 years. And the GOP, you know, they talked for years about, you know, we're trillions of dollars and, you know, we're in debt and we have all these deficits. None of that conversation has came up, you know, for years now. Well, especially since Donald Trump got in there, and now the attention is to, of course, blame the Mexicans, blame Muslims, blame the Black community for all your problems. And it's a shame that people have taken on this whole scapegoating. Here in the state of Georgia, just this past week, they purged over 591,000. people from the voter roll.
Wow.
There goes their attempt to change the next election.
Yeah, and I don't think it's a coincidence that after we saw basically a repeal of the Voting Rights Act that we see all of this new voter rights suppression. But I completely agree when it comes to the economy. I mean, if you want, just if we took away the racism from the negative sentiments towards immigrants, just factually, many of the arguments that they use are just wrong. Immigrants and undocumented workers are not taking our jobs. They're not negatively impacting our economy. In fact, if we took them out completely, our economy would be wrecked.
Well, we wouldn't have any vegetables on our plates or in our stores. Let's be clear that there are over, I think, 20,000 workers needed by agriculture here to pick our products, our apples, everything. Without them, we wouldn't get those.
So who's benefiting from this racism is the people that have set up this economic system that we have. And I think since our country's inception, you've had rich, mostly white people that are a part of the power structure convincing poor white people to fight their battles for them. I mean, we literally had a civil war that was basically a bunch of white people dying to hold for the right to hold slaves that would never actually hold slaves because they didn't have the money to do it. And we see that reoccurring where we have Donald Trump, a rich white person, convincing poor people that they are one step away from being Donald Trump. If it wasn't for the Mexicans, if it wasn't for the Muslims, if it wasn't for black people and Black Lives Matter, you could be like Donald Trump. So if we eliminate these people, it will free you to become the your inner billionaire. And they've been basically tricking poor white Americans into that narrative forever. And the thing is, when that has permeated through our culture, it's not just white people who can pick up that rhetoric and try to use it towards others. But there's only one group of people that's benefiting from the use of that rhetoric and racism.
I think I'm about to move back there in a couple of months now.
I did want to ask you one question. Who was the police chief when you were here? Do you remember?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, it was probably just one of those other crooked guys, the one who shot a friend while he was hunting by accident.
And then lied about it.
And then lied about it. And then, or, you know, they've all had integrity issues. I just wondered how you saw policing. And I'm wondering, if just briefly you can say how you experience policing differently in Atlanta, if you do.
Well, it's bad here. it's worse than Portland.
Oh, that's hard.
It's a police state. There Georgia has 200. Okay, Georgia has over 200 jails and close to 90 adult correctional facilities. So there's 300 wow. facilities here. To incarcerate people. It has the largest, number one facility from Corrections Corporation of America, Stewart Detention Facility, that holds the most undocumented immigrants in the whole country. It has over 500,000 people, 500,000 people under some type of probation. There's a private probation system here, so there's more people on probation than any place in the whole country. One out of every 12 persons is under some form of correctional control, when the national average is 1 in 36.
Wow. And to Greg's point, I think it's like a small group of people are really benefiting from that prison industrial complex of extracting exactly. wealth from the already impoverished and from brown bodies.
And the drug war rages on here. I don't know if you've read the report from the ACLU, the war on marijuana in black and white.
I have not read that.
Yeah, it came out in 2010. If you go online and check out the war on marijuana in black and white from the ACLU, it shows every state the racial profiling, where here in Atlanta, a black person is, in the city of Atlanta, 10 times more likely to be arrested for cannabis possession than a white person, even though white people use at the exact same rate all across the country, and in many places are using cannabis more, right. Than black and Latino people. So there's disproportionate arrest rates, but there are people fighting back. There's a strong progressive community here, and Black Lives Matter movement, Georgia Latino Alliance for Human Rights. There's a lot of organizations. There's actually probably more people active in resistance and fighting back here than in Portland, which was a surprise to me. But I still miss the progressive-minded folks of Portland, just because there's more of a consensus of like-minded people like yourselves in Portland than here. We're outnumbered here by these conservative Republican people who actually voted for Donald Trump, So, in closing, I didn't mean to take up all your time. I'm going to continue to stay tuned in to KBOO. And the last thing I wanted to just say is that, you can monitor how many people are being killed by police every day. There's a website called killedbypolice.net, And you can go on there and see that about 3 to 4 people are being killed across the United States.
It really is an epidemic. I mean, if we had...
It is. So keep up the great work. Your conversation is amazing, and you give me hope whenever I hear folks making sense like yourselves. So y'all have a great day, and look forward to listening in the future.
Yeah, thanks for calling in. On the police shootings, I have 2 points, actually. First, on the cannabis thing he said, and then also on the police shootings.
And this is Greg McKelvey of the Portland Resistance.
So we are, the numbers are already troubling, but then also we can look to other countries and see that we are blowing them out of the water when it comes to police shootings. There are countries that haven't had one in years. There's multiple countries that have single digit police shootings every year, and these are countries that have consistent terrorist attacks. And so if we really want to make America great, then why are we shooting people at this rate? And if you really believe in small government, then why are you for a police state where we're locking up our citizens and where we're shooting people in the street
at tremendous expense?
And not the human impact and just the monetary impact. I mean, we're talking about building a wall, we're talking about rounding up and deporting workers, we're talking about telling people who they can love or marry, and then we're doing it all saying that we believe in small government. But and to the point that he made about cannabis, I really encourage the people of Portland and Oregon in general. We're not done on that, because we have people sitting in jail right now, or who have a strike basically against them, or who are on probation and then got in trouble for another crime, that are in jail for doing the exact same thing that white people are getting rich for in Portland right now. So we need to go and look back and help salvage the people's lives who were affected by our failed prohibition of cannabis years ago.
I think that's a really important point you're making. There should be, as far as I'm concerned, there should be nobody in the country still jailed for any kind of marijuana crime, even selling it. I just think it's ridiculous that we should allow them to still stay there. But we have a government that would like to put us all backwards even further and mm-hmm. use this. I think they mostly want to use it as a way to go after people of color. And I'll bet you that if you did a survey, you would find that most white people think that people of color use more drugs. But statistically, over the last 40 years, every kind of survey done from any direction has shown that that is not true. That as a matter of fact, people identified as Caucasian use more drugs than any other racial group. I believe African Americans fall fairly low down that number. So that, we have a society that's taught us a bunch of lies about our own people.
And I think that's why we have to be hesitant towards, or at least define the term community policing, because we have to talk about whose community is being policed. Because like we said, that and for certain drugs, white people use at far higher rates. There are kids in Ted Wheeler's neighborhood, I guarantee you, lining up cocaine probably as we speak, while black kids are getting arrested for trace amounts of other drugs in their neighborhood. So if we're talking about community policing, we also need to talk about whose community are we policing. Because we don't see community policing in Ted Wheeler's neighborhood. We don't see community policing at the banks that wrecked our economy. We don't see community policing where we're community policing the police themselves. I mean, in instances that are really negatively impacting our community, we don't see community policing. But where we most often see community policing is in poor houses or minority neighborhoods.
Before we really are running out of time, and before we finish, I want one of you to list a couple of the questions, that's the most important questions you would be asking these police chief candidates, the questions that you want them to answer to the public, so that we can properly assess them. Can you bring up a couple of those?
Sure. I think that we went through a process in our group, a democratic process, to try to draft questions that we would be interested in knowing from the candidates. And those include things like, what experiences have you had with changing in with changing police culture, basically, at your previous employers. And that's something that I think is most important, because to Greg's point about no community policing within the police department, we hear a narrative of, oh, when there are police who are filmed, you know, planting evidence, like has just happened a few times in Baltimore, when there are...
And they just had to drop something like over 100 cases initially because of that planting, because that videotape. I'm sure they're going to have to go back and expunge other cases if the attorneys for the people who were arrested can make sure it happens.
I certainly hope that's the case. I'm not always encouraged the day after the first video became public of police officers planting evidence. Those same police officers were called to testify in a case the next day after it was made public.
So. But I have read that they've now dropped 100 pending cases that these men were going to be on. But the point is...
But the point is, when the narrative is it's just a few bad apples, where were all of the partners of those police officers over the years who were coming forward to say, you know, I'm working with a fellow officer who I think is a bad apple? The culture of policing has not encouraged, certainly in Portland and likely and definitely in other cities, has not encouraged within the department people coming forward to do the right thing and make sure that our police does not include white supremacists, does not include neo-Nazis, which in Portland there are several people who have that history.
I've actually found neo-Nazi cards in, you know, we have those little library boxes on the street where people say you can borrow a book and bring it back. I borrowed a book and out of it popped a white supremacist card with a website to go to. And so somebody has been planting them in there in a book that wouldn't have had anything to do with that subject. I know that one of the other things that you guys are asking the police is, how will you police non-permitted and permitted protests and demonstrations differently? We've been talking about mostly the, and I think probably the most important is white supremacy around these issues, but there are these other issues that you also are wanting to challenge. Can you talk a little bit about that, Greg?
Well, I think that protesting is one of the most American things we can do. I think there's nothing more American than using your First Amendment rights to push for change and to push for progress. And as we eliminate that right through the violent suppression of First Amendment rights seen under Mike Marshman, we're eliminating one of our main tools for progress. And I think that progress in our country has gone hand in hand with protest for all of the major things that we look back at. And I think that it's important for us to think about who we want to be looked at in history. I mean, there are statistics that show over 60% of Americans didn't approve of the Freedom Riders. There was a time where 70% of Americans thought that Martin Luther King had gone too far. So, who do you want to be? Do you want to be those people, or do you want to be the people that were standing with Martin Luther King or standing with the protest movements? And the way that we are policing protests right now is unsustainable. It's un-American. It's unpatriotic to be violently putting down people's First Amendment rights. A majority of people that come to protest, even protests that become a quote-unquote riot, a majority of the people that are there are not committing a crime. So it doesn't make sense that we're going to take away everybody's First Amendment right because somebody next to you may have committed a crime. None of our other rights work like that. The Second Amendment doesn't work like that, where I could say there was a murder last night, so we're kicking down the doors of everybody that peacefully exercises their Second Amendment right, and we're going to tear gas, pepper spray, beat them with batons because somebody messed up last night. But for some reason, we're willing to let that slide when it's the First Amendment, but the First Amendment is first for a reason. I don't mean to equate the two amendments. A lot more people have voices than guns.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's a really good way to do it. We have one more caller on the line. We should let him get in if we can. Oh, we lost him. I'm sorry about that, but that's all right. No need for anybody else to call in. We are in our last few minutes. And we've been speaking with two members of Portland Resistance, Greg McKelvey and James Offsink. And we've been talking about they put out a open letter to the candidates for the police chief here, asking them the kinds of questions they would want to ask them. And also we demanding more transparency from the mayor's office. But we've also been talking about Well, I just lost my next point, actually. Mm-hmm. Whatever it was, it went completely out of my head. But I think it's really important that we talk about who the next police chief will be. And I assume we're going to find out maybe even this week, maybe in the next time, and then we will hear other action. Well, I know the other thing I wanted to say is that you guys had talked about the possibility of investigating a recall of the mayor if, in fact, he selects someone who we find completely unacceptable. Can you just briefly say a few things about that?
Well, I think that many people have been disappointed in the mayor, especially when he ran on a very comprehensive and broad ways to reform the police department. We've seen basically none of that. We also see him working with the Justice Department, who is ran by Jeff Sessions, in basically dismantling our police accountability process. And I think it's important to stand with the NAACP and the AMA coalition to oppose those measures. So we have a mayor that already many people are disappointed in, but it would be a real slap in the face, I think, to the entire community when you ran on reforming the police department to pick the person who ran the police department while you were campaigning on reforming it.
It feels a bit like a bait and switch, doesn't it? We thought that he might be a little better than the last mayor, at least from his statements, and he's turned out to be a lot worse.
Correct.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today, Greg McKelvey and James Ofsink. This is Linda Olson-Osterlin for KBOO and for More Talk Radio. Thank all of you listeners. We appreciate you. You matter to us. We want to thank all of the callers who called in as well. And stay tuned. Coming up next will be at 9 will be the Ole Mole Variety Hour.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Guerrillas of Desire book launch with Kevin Van Meter on Thursday, August 10th at 7:30 at Powell's on Hawthorne in Portland. Guerrillas of Desire argues that the left is wrong. The strategies are often based on the assumption that working and poor people are unorganized or simply uninterested in building a new world. Again, that's Guerrillas of Desire book launch with Kevin Van Meter on Thursday, August 10th at 7:30 at Powell's Books, 3723 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the first annual Pan-African Festival of Oregon on Saturday, August 12th at Pioneer Courthouse Square, Portland. The first Pan-African Festival features entertainment, African food and clothing, informational booths, panel discussion, and more. The goal beyond that is to celebrate and illuminate the hidden treasures of the Pan-African community in Portland. Again, that's the first annual Pan-African Festival of Oregon on Saturday, August 12th at Pioneer Courthouse Square at Southwest Yamhill Street between Broadway and 6th in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.